It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day.
Welcome back to Lars, Lars and Joe, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. It's First Amendment Friday, my favorite day of the week, because we open up the phone lines and anybody who wants to comment is certainly welcome to do it. And every subject under the sun is fair game. We're going to start with taxes, both taxes here in the Northwest, and Joe Biden's latest nonsense of suggesting, and I'll play the sound bites for you, suggesting that America can spend trillions of dollars on things like what he calls an infrastructure plan. He keeps talking about roads and bridges, but most of that infrastructure plan is actually about electric car chargers and electric vehicle subsidies that mostly go to rich people in America. But then he says, we're doing it all, and the price tag is actually zero. I kid you not, he says it. I know if his lips are moving, he's probably lying. So we'll get to that in a moment, and to tolling as well. But I also want to throw out our Twitter poll for this First Amendment Friday. Once approved, should Northwest schools require vaccination of your kids for school attendance? Now, it was inspired by Tricia Brink, who wrote in to me. She listens in Washington State. She said, Lars, I hope you're going to cover this news story that came out about the Seattle School Board suggesting that the state mandate the vaccine for all school-age children. This is ludicrous. I knew the moment California did it, the liberals would be salivating over it. I sent my kids to a private Christian school, hoping to avoid much of the school public school nonsense. But even they will not be able to escape this. What can we do to stop it? Signed, Tricia Brink. Well, Tricia, I wish I had an idea. An immediate change of governor in both states, that would help. Big majorities for the Republicans in both states, that would help. But stopping it right now, if the courts will not do it, and you know that there are federal court actions going on right now, most of them involve labor unions. But then you have a right, I think, to ask as a citizen, is it going to be the case that if you're a state employee represented by a labor union, you will be treated differently as a public servant? You'll be treated better, with greater latitude, with greater freedoms than the citizens that you are paid to serve? Does anybody think that's the right idea? And of course, when I say, does anybody think that's the right idea, it reminds me that we always put naysayers to the head of the line. So if you think that is the right idea, I'd be glad to take your call, because on this show for almost 25 years, naysayers have always gone to the head of the line. At 866-HEY-LARS, that's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, our Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show, if you don't mind Twitter. If you don't like Twitter, go to my website. Vote counts the same, LarsLarson.com. And always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let me start with tolling. I'll get to Joe Biden in just a second. And again, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, naysayers, all you've got to do is have the guts, intestinal fortitude, body parts, whatever it takes to be able to call in, make your point, and get it done up front. There is nothing more frustrating for me and for you on a First Amendment Friday when somebody calls in and talks for 2 or 3 minutes, which, as you know, during a talk show is a good chunk of time, and then they say, but I didn't get to make my point. That's why Bryce, who is the phone screener and associate producer of this show, always tells people, put your point up front. Tell us the rest of the history and the details second, if you do it at all. 866-439-5277. Now, about tolling, the Taxpayers Association of Oregon in this case, although it has a dramatic effect on people who travel from Washington State into Oregon across that state boundary, plans to toll Oregon's busiest interstate highways, I-5 and I-205, are advancing this month. Now, they say these could actually be implemented within 5 years. And we've been talking about this tolling nonsense, and it is nonsense, for years. And I keep warning people, hoping that folks are going to get a head of steam built up about this, because what almost always happens, I warn you about, say, the corporate activity tax, and nobody notices until the tax actually shows up on a receipt. And that's when I get all these calls from people and emails saying, hey, where'd this come from? Who came up with this stupid idea? And I say, well, we warned you about it. Same thing with the long-term care tax. That one goes into effect January 1. But most of the complaints I'm going to hear about it, and most of the action by citizens, is probably going to happen after January 1. after people see their pockets being picked by Jay Inslee for this scam and a fraud of a long-term care tax. And I've described to you why it is a fraud. If a private company did this, the owners of that private company would probably be in jail. But what the Taxpayers Association points out, and it's worthwhile to point it out, Oregon ranks 11th highest gas tax in America. Registration fees are higher than the average state fees. Oregon has the nation's only bicycle tax. They just increased the truck tax by 25%. And by the way, if you say, I don't own a truck, doesn't matter. If you eat food, if you wear clothing, if you buy goods that arrive on a truck, you're paying that tax. You're just paying it through the cost of goods. Now, in 2017, politicians created a payroll tax dedicated to transportation. And despite all the new and the high transportation taxes, no new roads are built. No vehicle bridges are built. So now they're going to build toll roads. By the tens of millions, they're going to toll you. And most of that money is just going to pay for maintenance. And you wonder, where are the other billions of dollars going? They're going to a massive state bureaucracy. Now let's get to Joe Biden. Joe Biden is an unabashed liar. And let me back that up. He's telling folks that the government can spend trillions, that hasn't been approved yet, but it probably will be, and that it's all coming free of charge. I want you to listen to, first of all, his promise about no tax increases below $400,000. Take a listen.
Nobody who makes under $400,000 a year, which is a lot of money, will see their taxes go up one single penny. Nobody. Not one. That's why in the highway bill, I didn't add gas tax, so I keep that commitment. In fact, this plan cuts taxes for working people. There's no reason why, as I said, billionaires should pay a lower tax rate, literally a lower tax rate, than a school teacher and a firefighter, a couple.
Now, that is hogwash, and we all know it's hogwash. Taxes are going to go up on average, folks, and if you don't pay them directly to the government, you'll be paying them because Joe Biden seems to insist that the corporations are not going to pass those tax costs along. Listen to what he says about taxes.
My friends on the other side never had any problem creating $2 trillion in tax cuts for the very wealthy. Look, I don't think you shouldn't be able to make $1 million or $1 billion. I'm a capitalist, but guess what? I'm also listed for 36 years as the poorest man in the Congress. But I make money now. I'm a president. But all kidding aside, I don't think we should punish anybody, but just pay your fair share. Just pay your fair share.
Now he's back to that whispering nonsense. Pay your fair share. Okay, let's take a look at what the IRS says. The top 1% of wage earners in America, the people who make the most money in America, that would include people like Jeff Bezos of Seattle, Warren Buffett, people like that, Elon Musk, they're paying about 35 to 40% of the entire federal tax bill. The top 10%, and that does include that teacher and the firefighter or cop that the president talked about, they're paying 65% of the tax bill. How much exactly is the fair share? Coming up in a moment, we're going to talk about a lady who hates the cops, and she's on a city council here in the Northwest. Joanne Hardesty, coming up next on the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
In February this year, we aired a story where you said Portland does not have a gang problem. Our investigative reporter says that according to police, a significant number of shootings in Portland this year are gang related. Has your thinking changed on whether or not Portland has a gang problem?
There's been no data presented to me that proves that we in fact have a gang problem. If we do, we need to have a strategy to address that. But we cannot have a one size fit all approach to the diverse reasons why violence is taking place in our community.
Now, that's Joanne Hardesty. That's her voice. The voice you heard before that is K2 News anchor Steve Dunn asking her, isn't the murder problem about gangs? And Joanne Hardesty, well, she said, no, it's not about gangs. There's no evidence of that. Radical Portland City Council member Joanne Hardesty absolutely hates the cops, and her votes guarantee that she's going to get more of us killed. And I mean that literally. Portland cut almost 10% of its police budget last year with the support of Joanne Hardesty. This year, we're headed for a record number of homicides. Hardesty flatly denies that Portland's murder problem is a gang problem. Gangs are mostly criminals of color. Whether you like that or not, those are the facts on the ground. For Hardesty, color is a chip that she wears on both shoulders. This week, the Biden FBI identified gangs as the central issue in Portland's violence and murders, which completely puts the lie to what Joanne Hardesty has been trying to say. With Hardesty's ignorance, whether it's deliberate or just inadvertent, don't bet on refunding the police, which means more blood on the street. The commissioner has called the police liars. She has falsely accused them of setting fires that were actually set by rioters over the last year. She fired a private company whose business is repairing sidewalks for the city because that private company's private trucks display a back the blue flag sticker in support of the police. And she got them fired. It was Joanne Hardesty's action that did it. Yet when Joanne herself runs into trouble, let's say, for example, a bit tipsy on a ride home from her favorite casino, and a rideshare driver finds her so obnoxious he wants to let her out of the car, she calls the cops to resolve a personal matter. In her own home, she has what they call a police 900 box. Now, when you or I call 911, a dispatcher makes a decision. Do I send a police officer? How fast do I send a police officer? Does this citizen call even merit a police officer? It's different with a 900 box. When City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, who hates the cops, pushes the button on this special box, she gets an immediate, no questions asked, two-car, lights and siren police emergency response anytime she wants to push the button. And she hates the people who are coming out to help her with whatever problem she's got. Without double standards, Joanne Hardesty would simply have none at all. And a related email on this from retired police captain and detective C.W. Jensen. He says, Lars, Portland's murder problem is so much worse than 1987. The first drive-by killing was mine in 1988, meaning that he was investigating. Solved, of course. The detectives are overwhelmed right now. Everyone is shagging a killing or a serious shooting. Trust me, if you get shot and minor wounding, no follow-up on other serious crimes because you get assigned one murder a week. It's crazy. It's absolutely nuts. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, I have to admit, this is great news that we're now going to reopen our borders to foreign travelers, but only if they're vaccinated beginning November 8th. That's great news for everybody in Canada who wants to come down to Seattle, for everybody who wants to go up to Vancouver, BC. I can say that both trips are certainly worthwhile. But the White House announced we're going to let foreign travelers come in, but only if they are fully vaccinated. That's if you're coming from the north. Or from the east or the west. If you're coming from the south, you can cross the Mexican-American border without any vaccination and no stinking papers at all. Today's best email so far, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by River City Environmental. The leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest is now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Online, rivercityusa.com/careers. Charles Pace writes in, Lars, this is Barry Obama's third term for real. Susan Rice is his walking boss. The way you know that is that shortly after Barry came in hot on the circular firing squad, the Democrats all threw in behind Biden, following the lead of other leaders in Congress. A decrepit Biden becomes the comeback kid. The deal's very simple. The first black president gets a third term. Biden appears to be a spectator because he is a spectator. The fix is in. Obama is the man behind the curtain, signed Charles Pace. It is First Amendment Friday. Let's get to your calls. And if you want to join in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Let's go to Bob in Marysville, Washington. Hey, Bob, how are things on the slopes of Mount St. Helens?
Okay, Lars. What I want to talk about, the Biden administration, their proclaimed method of attacking illegal immigration was to eliminate the incentives for people to come here illegally. And just recently they said ICE will no longer be doing workplace raids where they went after places hiring illegal workers and deporting them.
Yep.
So in their effort to eliminate incentives, they just create one. I just can't get over it.
Well, they've taken away the enforcement. But, Bob, if you understand what the incentive is and all this nonsense from Kamala Harris saying we're going to take away the incentive, consider this incentive, Bob. If you lived in Guatemala and you were an average working stiff in Guatemala, I looked up the numbers. Do you know what the average working man or woman in Guatemala makes every year?
That's $700 or so?
$1,600. Now, you come to America, you might, in construction, you might make $1,600 a week. You'll at least make $1,600 every 2 weeks, and you'll certainly make more than $1,600 a month. So, if the pay differential between Guatemala and the United States is $1,600 a year for the average person working in Guatemala and $30,000 a year, 20 times as much money to come to the United States, how are they going to change that incentive unless all of a sudden they can bring Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and all those other lousy, you know, really low-rent countries? How do you change that if you don't dramatically increase the paychecks down there? And there's just no way to do it other than get rid of the corruption and turn those countries from socialist countries into capitalist countries like America.
Yeah, I think they want to give rocket chair pay to keep people down there.
I think they do. And the problem is we couldn't ship. I mean, even if Barack Obama came back with his airplanes full of cash, the kind he sent to the mad mullahs of Tehran, even airplanes full of cash could probably not shovel enough cash into the corrupt Central and South American countries to keep people happy. How do you boost people up 20-fold in the money they can make just by crossing the border illegally? And as you pointed out, you've got Joe Biden clearing the way for them. Coming up, should judges put Governor Kate Brown's vaccine demand, her mandate, on hold until all the facts are in? We're going to talk about that. It's First Amendment Friday, and I'll get to your phone calls and emails, too. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network on a First Amendment Friday, proudly serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on 24 great affiliate radio stations around this region. I'm glad to be with you, and I'm really glad to welcome back Jason Dudash, who's the director of the Freedom Foundation's Oregon chapter. Jason, glad to have you back. Over the last several weeks, I've been talking to a lot of doctors, nurses, firefighters, paramedics, prison workers and corrections officers and the unions that represent them. I mean, for a change, the unions and I are on the same page on this one. They're saying we have a right, our members have a right to make the decision about their medical care and not to have their HIPAA rights violated by having the boss demand to know, have you taken the jab? And so far, they've had mediocre success in the courts. Where is this one headed? Because I know Freedom Foundation is behind one of the efforts.
Yeah, Lars, you know that we brought a lawsuit. We're representing several public employees from all walks of life who have already contracted and recovered from COVID and therefore have acquired immunity to it. And I don't believe, Lars, that there is any logical or scientific reason for the state to require these people to get vaccinated at the threat of losing their jobs. So we've asked the judge to step in and put a temporary restraining order on this mandate. And just so happens to be funny enough that hearing is scheduled for Monday, October 18th, which sounds familiar because it's the same as the deadline date for this mandate. And Lars, this is really important, if I can, for a moment.
Sure.
Our state is not in a good spot, my friend. If you look at the landscape we're looking at, I know up north in Washington, Seattle Police Department, more than 25% of sworn officers, nearly 300 officers, are not vaccinated. Portland Police Department here in Oregon, they're not much better. Their numbers aren't as clear, but it's a huge percentage in an already dangerously strained department. Department of Corrections, 50%, Lars. 50% of the 4,500 corrections employees in the state of Oregon are not vaccinated. The Oregon Nurses Association saying that 60% of their staff are considering quitting working in nursing, and a huge percentage of that is because of these mandates. They're calling it historic and catastrophic, the shortages they're having. Eight counties here in Oregon have already declared a state of emergency. The mandate hasn't even happened yet. We've got till Monday. Eight counties have already declared a state of emergency for a lack of adequate resources to respond to basic needs. Just one example, the city of Warrenton, Lars, they have 3 paid firefighters, 20 volunteers. Of that, 9 are vaccinated, 14 are not. 13 are going to lose their jobs on Monday, and 2 more have said that they're going to quit in solidarity. That leaves 8 people to respond to emergencies, and only 3 of those 8 are EMS certified in a town of nearly 6,000. So, Lars, when that's what we're looking at in this state, how can anyone seriously push a policy that is going to fire tens of thousands of highly qualified, dedicated, and experienced public servants out of these critical services at a time when we so desperately need them?
And no, Jason, I agree with you. I've been melding together the problems of all the states, Idaho, not so much, but Oregon and Washington, you mentioned those. Think about even from the practical. We've got firefighters who are begging the town of Redmond, Washington, to let them stay on the job without the vax, to make their own decision. They're not going to be told yes. We've got teachers who are being shown the door. We've got a ferry system that serves Puget Sound that's already announced we're cutting a whole bunch of our routes. They've got one on Lopez Island. You can either make the 10 o'clock ferry or the 7 o'clock ferry. And this isn't just about working commuters. It's about how do you get services out to that island? And I'm talking about plumbers, electricians, all these things. You say either make the 10 o'clock or you make the 7 o'clock. And the electrician says, I'm not coming out to the island at 10 o'clock in the morning and then sitting around for 9 hours till I can get off the island at 7 o'clock at night and get to my home at 9 o'clock at night. You know, none of this works. And they are absolutely, you know, they're devastating all of the basic essential services of any civilized society in any community in this country anyway, the things that people expect. And people are still paying the tax bill. They're just not going to get the services. This is outrageous.
No, it is outrageous, and it's entirely preventable, which is why it's so infuriating. If we do this, Lars, it will plunge our state into an entirely new crisis of which we have never seen, and it will 100% be the fault of this governor-turned-despot, Kate Brown. And we need to do everything we can, which is why this lawsuit's so important. And really, I think I'm being pretty reasonable here, Lars. The state should want to agree with us on this. When they're looking at this landscape that we're in, everything I've talked about, everything you just mentioned, they should want to be able to alleviate as much as they can in the pressure building up there. And that's what we're asking for. We're saying that, yes, we recognize that COVID is real and it's dangerous, right? We recognize
yep.
that vaccines are good.
That.
And people should take them, and we can thank President Trump for 3 wonderful vaccines that he gave to this president we have now. That's all fine and good. However, that is an individual choice that people should be making. And when you're looking at a population of the state of Oregon, of all across the country, huge amounts of people who have already been infected and recovered, they have immunity to this virus that is just as good, if not better.
No, it's better. According to all the studies I've seen, Jason, it's better. And they're not being recognized at all to say, yes,
exactly.
You've already had it. Okay, then it's your choice whether to get the vax. And Jason, to a large extent, I don't even understand this absolute frenzy to get people vaxxed. Because when I look at what happened in Israel, a highly vaccinated country that had a huge surge of cases, Singapore, an island nation that has a better ability to control who comes and goes, they were vaccinated into the 80 percentiles, and they still had a big surge. Iceland, the same thing. So when people say, well, all we have to do is get all you idiots out there to get vaccinated, and that'll solve the problem, it hasn't solved the problem elsewhere on planet Earth. So why would we expect it to happen here?
Well, it won't. It won't, Lars. And that's why we need the courts to step in. When that's the backdrop of what we're looking at, how can you, in good conscience, justify firing all of these people, especially for a population that already has acquired immunity? There is simply no argument that they can make. And that's why we need the judge to step in and put a restraining order on this come Monday. And if they don't, I'm afraid that they're going to share in just as much responsibility for the crisis our state's about to go in as this governor.
Well, Jason, I'm hoping you brought it. I don't think you deliberately brought it at the 11th hour. But when a judge looks at this
and
says, there,
there is going to be lasting damage. We've got nurses who are being told you will be delicensed by Kate Brown if you don't take the jab. So not only are you out of a job, you're out of any job in Oregon or Washington. Leave the region. You are banned as unvaxxed. That if you say, if the judge can't see that he's going to cause people to have to move, to sell their homes, to pull up their roots, to move to a different part of America, to be able to just keep working, if a judge isn't persuaded by that as exactly the thing TROs are designed for, that I'm sure your lawyers are making the case to the judge, if you allow damage that cannot really be undone after the damage is done. I mean, if 3 months from now a judge decides and says, hey, by the way, ma'am or sir, you had to quit your job, your husband had to quit his job, you had to sell your house, you pulled your kids up out of school, you moved three states away, you found more work in the same field from a state that would actually appreciate it and allow you, come on back. There's no way to, you know, put that toothpaste back in the tube. And Jason, you know that. And I have to applaud you for doing this because people are asking me, are there any efforts to try to stop this nonsense? And I said, yeah, we got Freedom Foundation. We got multiple groups. You've got firstliberty.org. They're all working on it. But unfortunately, the court system doesn't work fast enough. I hope we hear about your success on Tuesday or late Monday afternoon. That's Jason Dudash from the Freedom Foundation. Coming up in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. It is First Amendment Friday. And what about that cry at the airport for empty shelves, Joe? We'll talk about that as well. You're listening. Oh, and should we stand up for the rights of girls in sports? Texas did it. Should the Northwest follow? We'll get to all of that next.
I'm getting nothing for Christmas. Joe screwed up our supply chain. I'm getting nothing for Christmas. Cause Joe Biden's truly insane. His policy shut production down. Let's blame it all on Joe. Somebody needs to stop this clown.
Come back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to mention something, too. If you wonder to yourself, doesn't Joe Biden have a transportation secretary who should be helping to solve this problem? You know, the supply chain collapse that leaves ships sitting offshore and trucks that can't handle the loads and trains and everything else. And a big part of the problem is California with its crazy rules for trucks and everything else. Oh, and by the way, crazy rules for owner operators of trucks. Yeah, well, you might wonder, well, where is that transportation secretary? What was his name? The guy who couldn't get the roads paved in South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg? Guess what? Pete Buttigieg is on paternity leave. He and his husband have two brand new babies, and Buttigieg decided to take paternity leave for 2 months. He's been off since mid-August. He is very nearly to the two-month stage where he's been off the job for 2 months in the middle of a transportation crisis. The transportation secretary has decided to stay home with the babies. Now, if anybody thinks that's right, you give me a call and be a naysayer today. To your calls now. Let's start with John. Hey, John, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Well, my wife and I have a care home, and we've been forced to get the vaccination, even yep. though the clients in our care homes are not forced to get the vaccination. Kate Brown is telling us that if we don't get the vaccination, that they're going to close our care home down and remove all the people out of our care home, which have severe disabilities, cognitive, physical, and mental. And there's already a huge staffing issue where they're closing care homes down. And we have a union, and the union's not doing anything.
Of course not. There are a few unions that are, and there are a lot that are not. John, my stepdaughter has worked and still works in the same industry you're in, that is taking care of people who cannot take care of themselves in a home. They don't all have to be elderly. Sometimes it's mental difficulties and things like that. So, John, I take it if the state closes you down and says send these people elsewhere, there is no elsewhere to send them to, is there?
No, and that's a big thing, is that a lot of these people have different supports. So if you have a home that maybe some might support elderly people, it doesn't mean that you can send people like from my home or other people's home to that home because they got a vaccination. For instance, we have some colleagues that have a home, and they take people straight out of prison. These are people that are sexual offenders, violent offenders, and you have to have certain classes and certain certifications to have these people in your home to take care of them properly, to give them the proper supports, to make sure that they get the things they need. And it's very frustrating because it seems like these people who we're taking care of have more rights than we do. They don't.
It does sound like that. John, thanks a lot for a call on First Amendment Friday. Let's go to Jan next. Jan, it's First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
What if all this is part of their plan?
I think it is.
The collapse of the medical field. Absolutely. And you know what? The people that this is affecting are going to private industries with less than 100 people. They're welcoming them with open arms. They're just so sad to me. I know a person personally at St. Charles here. She's worked there for 20 years. Today's her last day.
Yep.
Today's her last day. And it's really sad to me that a lot of these people are having to make the shift. But you know what? The people that are standing up for their rights are the backbone of America. They're going to get through it. They're going to find a new way. Businesses are going to find a new way. Hopefully this man that you were just talking to can find a new way. And that's what we're all about.
What does he do with all these dependent people? You've got elderly people in care homes. You've got people with mental developmental disabilities in care homes, and they're going to be dumped.
Right.
And there's no place for them. I know that there's no place for them to go.
He's not the person that put them there. And he probably won't be the one to rehome them either. And you know what? Maybe there is a better. I hope this guy's business stays around because we need that. But they're not going to be out on the street. The government will put them into a different facility. They're not going to.
If there is, but Jan, all I'm saying is, if there is one, and having heard it from my stepdaughter, you know, because she was a manager, she works in that industry, she takes care of people, and and she can't find workers. She can't because it's tough. I mean, this is not a 7-Eleven job. This is not a job in Nordstrom. This is a job taking care of people who have difficulties, and that means they're difficult to take care of in many cases. And it's hard to hang on. It was hard to hang on to workers before the pandemic arrived, before the mandates arrived. All I'm saying is they're putting these people at real risk, and they are going to end up killing people. Jan, thanks for the call. Coming up, I've got a very special guest. Victor Davis Hanson is one of the smartest guys I know, and then we'll get to your calls on First Amendment Friday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to phone calls and all that a bit later. As you know, naysayers go to the head of the line on this show. So if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's at 866-439-5277. You can remember that as 866-HEY-LARS. My email is almost as easy, talk@LarsLarson.com. And I have the great pleasure of bringing back on the program a man who's brought so much education and insight to this program, Dr. Victor Davis Hanson. Dr. Hanson, it's a pleasure to have on a man who is both a professor of the classics, but also a farmer, because you actually have your hands in the dirt, unlike so many of the elites at some of the big universities.
Thank you for having me, Lars. I appreciate it.
Now, tell me about this. Before we get into talking about the specifics of The Dying Citizen, your newest book, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization Are Destroying the Idea of America, would you mind sharing with my audience how well the book is doing, and then mysteriously something happened to it at Amazon? Would you mind describing that, please?
Yeah, I mean, they asked me to go to New York, and I did 12 hours of publicity, and I think the book is very timely, although it wasn't written right after the Biden administration. A lot of things it predicted were borne out by this chaos we're watching, and explains why this chaos is here. But so the first day was last Tuesday, a week ago today, and the book just took off. It was number two within a few hours of release. And all of a sudden, you know, the media was besieged. And then 24 hours later, this little thing popped up on Amazon. It said, soon to be in stock, and you couldn't get the book. You could order it. And, of course, then my publisher and agent, everybody said, what's going on? They've got plenty of copies. And then they were told, well, for rankings or degrees of success, it's only the amount of books are shipped, not purchased. So there was this huge gap from people ordering the book, even though they couldn't get it right away, and what was recorded as the book's progress, because they were not shipping the book. So the ranking started to drop, because even though they were getting more and more orders every day, they were shipping few, to the point within 48 hours, they were shipping none. And so that was kind of, and we're still in that situation, and nobody can figure out why that happened.
Well, I'm going to ask you, do you think it's deliberate on the part of Amazon, saying we can't let a book like this by a guy like that, Dr. Victor Davis Hanson, you know, who belies the stereotype, and doctor, forgive me, this is meant in the spirit in which it's offered. An awful lot of the left says, oh, all the people who believe these other ideas and who don't like what President Biden and Kamala Harris are doing to the country, they're uneducated, they are trailer park trash, they're rednecks, which actually is a compliment in my circles, but it can't be anybody smart. And then along comes Dr. Victor Davis Hanson with the kind of resume you've got, and they can't say this is all just a bunch of dummies that are opposing what we're doing.
I don't know. I just know that I can tell you that it's never happened to me before. And I can tell you my agent, who's very, very sophisticated, he's been around for 30 years with it, cannot explain it. And I know that the publisher, Basic Books, has given them enormous amounts of books. And I don't know if they were overwhelmed with their first initial orders or what happened, supply chain, but I know that they're not telling us. And I just am baffled. But all I can tell you is that you will get the book if you order it. It's just that for purposes of ranking and perceptions of the book's success, New York Times or Amazon's ranking, they're only based on the actual numbers of shipped books, not purchased books, and they're not shipping them, even though they're at their disposal. And we're trying to find out. It's taken a week, but they only ship them for 36 hours.
I just think this is a piece of data that people ought to take into account, that a company like Amazon that began by selling books and now sells everything, that ships, I don't know, hundreds of millions of items every week, is suddenly incapable of managing the sale of a book, we just can't get them out the door. What the heck? That one doesn't smell right, doctor.
No, my best friend Shelby Steele at the Hoover, he had a great film on documentary on Ferguson, and they would not sell it for 3 weeks. And then they relented. So I think that they do manipulate. I don't know if I can prove it, but it's something strange. I've written 24 books. This never happened. I've never had more interest in a book, to tell you the truth. I've written some books that have been on the New York Times bestseller, but never have I had such an interest in this book, because it's kind of uncanny. I didn't know that when I finished it in January, it was going to fit and predict what's happening because of the dying citizen. But, and one very quickly thing, Lars,
yes,
I think that's a really good point you made about working people. I was given either a curse or a benefit of working on a farm and then going to Stanford back and forth the last few years. And I can tell you that as somebody who farmed full-time and lives now with people, there's no comparison in the degree of intelligence and capability required for a guy to get on a tractor or to run a business and labor and markets versus a tenured academic like myself. I can tell you I did both, and the people that I worked with or I see that run a 7-Eleven and have to keep inventory in their head, or a long-term trucker that has that muscular and cerebral demands on them compared to a guy who's got their summers off, who's a teacher. I just, there's no comparisons.
Dr. Hanson is the author most recently of The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalism Are Destroying the Idea of America. Well, doctor, I think one of the reasons this is so important, we'll get into the chaos, we'll get into the book, but it's important because you get memes like the one that was pushed out. Why the people who are hesitant about taking the vaccine, they're dummies, they're generally older, they're generally Trump fans, and they're generally uneducated. And then I saw some, I think it was Pew Research, where they actually went out and did polls and found out the most resistant class by age
was younger people, 18 to 35, and the most resistant by education were PhDs, strangely enough. And I remember thinking, well, that completely blows up the entire narrative that the only people who aren't accepting this are dummies. And now we're seeing the evidence in doctors, nurses, airline pilots, police officers, paramedics. I mean, some really, you know, substantial people with substantial skills who are saying, I'm not crazy about this idea and don't make me do it. This is part of the chaos you've referred to, isn't it?
It is. And I think that the left thought that because they control, as I said in the book, they control Silicon Valley, public radio, public TV, television, Hollywood, entertainment, professional sports, Silicon Valley, the media, et cetera, universities K through 12, that they didn't need to have a majority of the citizens, that they don't care if they're losing the, by a large margin, the polling on the border or critical race theory or stagflationary policies or Afghanistan. They just feel, you know what, we have so many institutions and we have so many levers of influence and power and money that we don't care anymore.
I'm talking to Dr. Victor Davis Hanson, as he said, a couple of dozen books to his credit on everything from Mexifornia to histories of the Peloponnesian War, and most recently, The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization. I said globalism. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and emails and all that a bit later. It is such a pleasure to have Victor Davis Hanson with me, and we'll be returning in a moment on The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your emails and phone calls. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll, and believe me, we're going to get that to be a Getter poll the minute Getter has the technology to do it. So far, though, it's a Twitter poll, at Lars Larson Show. And if you want to vote on my website to avoid the Jack Dorsey censorship, just go to LarsLarson.com. I have the great pleasure of talking to a man I so admire, Victor Davis Hanson, university professor of the classics, the author of a couple of dozen books, most recently The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization Are Destroying the Idea of America. Doctor, that's my Bernice in the background. He hangs out in the studio with me. He's Sir Winston Churchill, but he's sometimes frustrated when people come, you know, to the studio and he wants to go out and say hi. I want to ask you, let's start. You touched on it a bit in the last segment about what is the idea of America, because there are now probably a thousand ideas, but the main ideas, those that I believe in, that you believe in, of an America that is a good America, an aspirational America, that wrote a constitution that had the unique idea of rights given by God, not by granted by a generous government. And then we have an America that is somehow based in slavery and evil. And those are two very different Americas. Let's talk about why the left, why these progressive elites so badly want to destroy the kind of idea that you and I believe in.
Well, I think they believe in socialism and a quality of result, which they've renamed equity, and that's all going to be adjudicated by people like Nancy Pelosi from her Napa estate worth $100 million, or Oprah worth, you know, $1 billion, or the Obamas, or Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates. This elite that feels that they're so morally superior to everybody, they're not subject to the consequences of this crazy ideology they're inflicting on other people. And you're absolutely right that our founders understood that we weren't perfect. We didn't have to be perfect to be better than the alternative. And that was clear from the very beginning. They understood slavery was a problem. They didn't want to go to a civil war right after fighting the British, and they had to make compromises. But it was a self-correcting constitution. It was a Bill of Rights. It was a freedom of expression. There was constitutional remedies. There were amendments. So they understood that times change, even though human nature did not. And they gave us this wonderful framework, and it's made the most prosperous, free, successful nation in the history of civilization. But some people don't like it, and they've never liked it because they're out of power, or they feel that they're smarter than other people, they're more moral, nobody listens to them, and they're very angry. And so they always try to wage a top-down revolution. And this is what it is. This is Phyllis Queller, BLM co-founder, self-prescribed Marxist, you know, four homes now, Topanga Canyon, all-white neighborhood. And that's supposed to be a revolutionary fervor. Or Professor Kendi charging $20,000 for a Zoom hour.
He's the CRT author, effectively, or architect.
Yeah. So this is not average day people. Most people want to get along. They don't. I live in a mostly a Mexican-American community. I can tell you that most people do not judge you on the superficial appearance of yourself. They're into the American ideal of the melting pot, and we all have a common ideal. But the left's message is not polling well. It never did. So they have two alternatives, Lars. They either have to change the demography of letting in 2 million people this fiscal year so that we are all almost up to 45 million people who were not born in the United States that are in the country either legally or illegally. 27% of the state was not born. That makes it very hard to assimilate and integrate or intermarry into the body politic when the host doesn't teach them American civics. And then the other thing is they think, you know what, this electoral college does not work anymore for us. A 9-person Supreme Court doesn't work for us. The filibuster does not work for us on the left. The national constitution that says the states are primarily responsible for national election balloting does not work for us. A 50-state union does not work. So we're just going to change it all and call anybody who objects a racist. And that's what they're up to because they have no confidence in their message. And they know that most people, without a crisis, and remember, that's what Rahm Emanuel, never let a serious crisis go to war. That's what Gavin Newsom said as soon as he locked us down. This is a chance during the lockdown to create a more progressive capitalism, he said. And Hillary Clinton said, this is our final and best chance to get one-payer health care. They all have been saying that. And under normal times, no one would want to enlist in that cause. But now, when the people are locked down, you have a self-created recession, this misinformation, and terror about the COVID and the quote-unquote science being abused for political reasons. That's what they want, and they want to change the system, and they want to change even the demography of the country.
Professor Victor Davis Hanson is the author most recently of The Dying Citizen, a bestseller, but get Amazon to admit that today. How progressive elites, tribalism, and globalization are destroying the idea of America. Let me ask you this, Professor. You referred in the last segment to the chaos that's going on right now. So based on what you've just said about this fervor on the left to change a system that is unique and exceptional on the planet, affords liberties that can't be taken away because they were granted to us by God. And I'll quote JFK on that too, who said the revolutionary idea in his inaugural that our rights come from God and not from the generosity of government. How much of this chaos is deliberate and how much of it is incompetence, where they say, if we're going to make these changes, we can't get them through the courts or the legislature or any other way. We can't get them by getting the agreement of the people. So we will create enough chaos that in the midst of that chaos, we can invent institutions like paying people not to work when America needs 11 million workers right now. And that will create the change we've been seeking that we can't get through the regular means of government.
You know, that's the $64,000 question, Lars. I get asked that, and I'm sure you do. I get asked that 10 times a day in calls and emails. People say, nobody could be this stupid to create this chaos, these crazy ideas of printing new money and thinking it's going to give prosperity and calling it new monetary theory. Is this deliberate, or are they just that stupid and incompetent? And I think what maybe we could split the difference is I think they came in thinking Donald Trump is unpopular, he's controversial, COVID did him in, now there's a referendum on us, even though there wasn't. It was 50-50 in the Senate, and they've lost in the last midterm House seats. But nevertheless, they convinced themselves that they had the power and they had this utopian dream. And then when they started to enact it, it blew up in their face, whether Afghanistan or the border, and everybody didn't like it. And now their attitude is, okay, it didn't work. They didn't appreciate our genius, but we're going to push this stuff through because we got two more years at least before Joe Biden is out, and maybe a year until the next midterm. And we're going to try to get these edicts and executive orders and platforms and policies institutionalized, or at least have them do so much damage that, you know, you can't recover. So we're just going to stop the wall and let the stuff rot right there. You know, we paid for it. And then you'll have to do that. We're going to have catch and release. We're going to alienate the South American, the Central American, Mexican governments in a way that we didn't do before. Or we're just going to, you know, get rid of deterrence. We're just going to get out of Afghanistan, and that's it. We don't care.
His book is called The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization Are Destroying the Idea of America. We'll be back in just a moment. Then we'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Email talk@LarsLarsen.com and tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on a First Amendment Friday. Always glad to be with you and always glad to get your phone calls and your emails. I will get to those in a moment, but there's an issue that popped up today. It's because of a brand new development in a horrific incident that happened 3 years ago in Parkland, Florida. It was actually Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. You may remember it. 17 counts of premeditated murder, 17 counts of attempted murder. And I know that a lot of people try to avoid his name, but I will simply say Nicholas Cruz is the man accused of those crimes. I don't think there's any doubt that he committed those crimes. And the crimes he committed not only expose the danger of that one individual who needs to be incapacitated for the rest of his life, but it also exposed a lot of flaws in school resource officers in some jurisdictions, in the the Broward County Sheriff's Department that so pathetically responded to that incident. I wanted to find out what Andy Pollack thinks of this. Andy's 18-year-old daughter, Meadow Pollack, was murdered at the Stoneman Douglas High School shooting. He is the author of the book called Why Meadow Died, and he also has done his part to try to make school safety better through a site called schoolsafetygrant.org. Andy, thanks for coming on the program, and tell me this. We got word that Nicholas Cruz, I'll say his name there, is prepared to plead guilty on all counts, and you and I talked for a moment on the phone today. Look, I've told people that plea deals are, you know, both good and bad. I mean, the good is, you know, for certain there will be a guilty finding. There is no doubt. And sometimes cases can leave doubt. This one doesn't seem like one of those, but you have certainty. Then tell me this, are you okay with the idea that instead of, say, facing the death penalty, that Nicholas Cruz would simply plead guilty on all counts and be appropriately punished?
Well, first, I'd just like to go over a few things so your listeners can understand where I'm coming from.
I'm glad for that.
Okay, Lars. So after once my daughter was murdered, okay, I really tried to focus on holding people accountable that failed in Broward. Because when the murderer was caught, he was put away, you know, in jail. And focusing my energy towards this thing that was in jail wasn't really what I wanted to do. And I had, like, my daughter, for her, I had to find accountability. And it started in the district. And the first thing that I got involved with was writing that book, Why Meadow Died. And I focused on all the, you know, those diversionary programs you had me on. We spoke about them, the diversionary programs that gave students 4 misdemeanors per school year without ever getting introduced to law enforcement. So I exposed that. I wrote the book for parents so they could read it and understand what goes on in these big public school districts. So I did that, the book. Next, I had to focus on a guy named Ron DeSantis. Okay, he's a super governor in the country. Everybody heard of him. So when I met Ron in Broward, I met him at a dinner. And he told me before he was governor, he told me that he was running on holding people accountable. So I met him. I said, Ron, you know, if that's what you're going to do, I'm going to get behind you and help in your campaign like never before. So I pushed so hard to get Ron DeSantis elected in the state of Florida. And it worked. You know, he barely won by the skin of his teeth. And we know the other guy that he was running for was found in a hotel with meth, with prostitutes in his hotel room. The other guy, Gillum, his name was. So Ron wins. Within the first month, he removed that failed Sheriff Israel. So I don't know if everyone, you know, we're out on the West Coast. They don't know. Ron DeSantis came down to Florida to Broward County. He met me at the sheriff's office and removed Israel from office, which was unbelievable for me. It was holding people accountable.
Yep.
Next, what I worked on with Ron was putting a grand jury investigation into the Broward School District. Okay, and Ron did it. You know, Lost. He followed through with what he told me he was going to do. So since then, people don't, you might not even have heard this. The superintendent who brought all those policies from Chicago was arrested on perjury charges through this grand jury investigation. So to me, that meant so much to me, holding these other people accountable, that I really didn't focus. I don't really focus that much on this trial or what's going on. So getting that out of the way, what my focus was holding these people accountable.
Yep.
So now it comes to this plea bargain that all of a sudden, it's all over national news. You know, you're hearing about it. We're out on the West Coast. And, you know, I live out here in Oregon now.
Yeah, you moved out from Florida.
He was always taking a plea of guilty. He was always going to plead guilty to avoid the death penalty. That was always on the table. So now what, this is coming from attorneys that are involved in the case that I spoke to. So now, in a capital punishment case, and you probably know more about this, there's two trials. There's one for the guilty part, and then there's one for the sentencing. So yep. We're back to now. So they take out the guilty part now because now he pleaded guilty on all counts. So now they're just back to square one. The way I'm looking at it is they're going to have a trial. I'm hoping they expose all these failures in the trial, which is there's a motion in place for third-party failures, systematic failures might not be allowed in the case, which I want them in the case. I want all the failures exposed. So they still have to have a trial by jury to decide his fate still. So we're still on the same boat, just one trial less. I hope I didn't talk too much.
But I'm glad for the background, and I think my audience is too. But what I want to know is I've met crime victim families who say we don't want the person put to death because of their own beliefs. I get that. I don't think that should be definitive, but you should have a lot of say. I think the state decides how they're going to punish people for committing certain crimes in every state, and punishments are different from state to state. But I wondered whether or not you are satisfied. If he says, I'll plead guilty, but you have to give me a pass on the death penalty, you know he'll still continue his efforts to get a new trial, to get, you know, some kind of relief down the way. And I always worry that state lawmakers or governors will say, well, I'm just going to simply say he's been there 20 years, because this will happen a long time from now, and we're going to cut him loose. And I worry about that. If you execute him, you don't have that problem. Are you, as the father of Meadow Pollock, satisfied if he takes the plea and effectively gets locked up for the rest of his life, if that happens?
Well, first of all, if they let him out, I doubt they're going to let him out, but I wouldn't mind them letting him out, the laws between me and you. Let him out, you know, because justice will come, you know, yep. In one way or another. But yep. I don't ever see him getting out of prison, laws.
And I hope not.
So with the death penalty, there's going to be another appeal. And to me, the way it drags on so long, it's not much of a deterrent when they kill someone 20 years later. You know, I would want the death penalty where when there's such an open and shut case, you got to execute these monsters much faster. So there is a deterrent.
I agree.
20 years later, who's even thinking about it? So it's not a deterrent for the next nut job to go out there and commit a horrific act. So
I totally agree with you.
I don't see the deterrent in the 20 years down the line killing them. I don't care what they do to them. You know, look what happened. I'm hoping what happened to Jeffrey Dahmer happens to the killer. He went to prison, and he ended up one night getting hit by a pipe 100 times in the head, and he never woke up. So I don't really know. I don't really think about it. I don't know. It's strange. I really don't think about them killing him, not killing him, putting him in prison. It's not my main focus. I don't know.
Well, Andy Pollock is the father of Meadow Pollock, who was murdered 3 years ago in Parkland, Florida, at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High. SchoolSafetyGrant.org is the organization you run now. Man works a job. He does what he can to try to help to fix the problems in the system that let those murders happen 3 years ago. We'll be back in just a moment. It's First Amendment Friday. I'll get to your phone calls and an email from a teacher in a moment.
Welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. This segment brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles. You pick the closing date, NickShivers.com for details. Now, we promise attention to both calls and emails. I got this email from Evelyn McLean, who has a master's in education. She says, Lars, please, please, please cover the topic of Oregon dropping the standards for substitute teachers. Kate has blanked us again, use the word I can't use on the radio, as a teacher of 20-plus years and a private business owner who runs a tutoring center. I'm appalled by Kate's latest blow to education. CNN has covered this, as has K2. We've covered it as well. They've decided that for substitute teachers, you don't even have to have a bachelor's degree anymore. No longer will substitute teachers need a bachelor's degree, a high school degree, a background check, no training, no interview process. Substitutes with a high school diploma, which will now be welcomed into our schools. I'm terrified. I think this really needs to be out there for parents to write into their school districts and demand better for their kids. The new rule allows anyone with a 1.0 GPA to walk into our classrooms, have access to kids' personal data, and great opportunities for pedophiles. You rock. Thanks. Listen, I'm with you. I brought this up the other day and said Kate Brown first lowers the standards for students. You don't have to read, write, or count to be able to get a high school diploma in Oregon. That was made law last year. Now she says, let's drop the standards for teachers. Not the paychecks, but the standards. And if that makes sense to any of you, please let me know why. Let's go to Ron in Tacoma. Hey, Ron, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Just to let you know, here in the last couple of weeks, I've been sending you some information. I'm not sure if you got to review it, reference actual global warming science.
Yeah, we talk about the subject all the time, and I appreciate all the input. What would you like to tell my audience today?
Well, I sent you a couple of links. I'd like to know why the American public is paying for NASA when NASA's been caught lying to the American public. I sent you both links on this subject.
Okay, I'll take a look at it. But Ron, I look at all the emails I get. But when you get on and you want to have a private conversation with me, and the audience doesn't have a clue what you're talking about, we try to afford people an opportunity to get on and make a point about the news of the day. Why are we paying for NASA? Does NASA do some things that are designed, depending on the administration, to either push global warming nonsense or to not do that? Usually it comes down to who's in charge in the White House. And unfortunately, Joe Biden and his Democrats managed to cheat back in November. Let's go to Ron in Salem, a different Ron. Ron, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
This is your black redneck brother from another mother. I'm going to address three things. Hard and nasty. She needs Jesus. She's acting just like Maxine Waters did 49 years ago. Power, deception, undermining the law enforcement. Now, the main subject I want to talk about is basically, you know, the Christmas tree bill, as I call it, that will affect all of us Americans and may kill the rest of our industrial side of our businesses, the $3.5 trillion. You know, Lars, people don't realize cap and trade doesn't work. Look at California. You're wondering why trucks that 2005 yep. or yeah. older that get better mileage than the new trucks yep. by 2.5 yep. to 3 miles to a gallon will not go yep. to California through Nevada, Oregon, or California or Arizona.
Well, they can't. I mean, Ron, this is one of the pieces of the supply chain nonsense that's not getting dealt with because what? Our transportation secretary is on 2 months of paternity leave with his husband. I mean, this is how crazy the country's become. In California, if you drive into that state in a truck, a long haul truck that is not meeting the California standards, they will tell you to park the truck. And they will tow the truck out of the state. They will not let you operate it in the state of California. And as you point out, it lowers the efficiency of the trucks. It makes certain trucks just unavailable. And yet you've got some of the biggest ports on the West Coast are located in California. So when the president says, well, just have the truck drivers work more hours, well, there are federal rules on that as well. But if a bunch of truck drivers who all have rigs that are not Cali compliant said, we'll go down and haul freight, they couldn't do it because the state of California has locked them out. You're right.
It's not economically feasible. It's a friend of mine drove 135,000 miles 1 year. He has a fleet of trucks hauled NFR, PBR stuff and everything else. For his 2005 truck, we got about 8.5 to 9 miles to a gallon with 112,000 pounds of animals. He spent $59,000. The truck that he bought 2019 cost him $81,000 in fuel costs at $3.49 a gallon average within the western states. And then you had $17,000 worth of death costs. Now, the thing is this, what nobody don't understand in that bill.
Death, by the way, is not hard of hearing, people. It's diesel exhaust fluid. But go ahead, just so everybody understands.
Diesel exhaust fluid. But the thing is this, it killed the incentive, like my father, who was a beekeeper, went from 8,000 hives 7 years ago to 1,000 hives. And the biggest thing is that in that golden parachute package that they said, we're going to try to save the environment, it's going to cost me. First of all, they want to monitor your vehicle with a GPS device driving anywhere, and they're going to tax you on that. Then they want to go through and tax, put the globalist tax on at 20-something percent, 15-25%. And so what it does, it kills our manufacturing. It kills the incentive. Who eats the cost? Me and you. And then on top of that, your power, your utility, your energy, your transportation costs will be, again, hit us. We'll be hit from six different sides of a two-sided board that
and
economically
when,
will make
and
us
Ron,
poor.
Ron, because we're coming up to a break, when you get to the point where you make the goods too expensive to manufacture and then bring to marketplace in America, you know where the manufacturing goes? It goes overseas, because that's the only choice. And when energy prices go high, we no longer have a vigorous economy. It's First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a First Amendment Friday, as we say, and your calls are welcome. I began today by talking about what is effectively the dissolution of some of the major city police departments here in the Pacific Northwest. Seattle is looking at losing hundreds of police officers. Portland, the same. Some of that is vaccine mandates. Some of that is simply not supporting the officers in a way, shape, or form by tying their hands while terrible things happen in the bigger cities of the Pacific Northwest. Murders, rapes, assaults, and the like. And this dramatic rise is simply being denied by some people, most notably by Joanne Hardesty, who I consider a radical cop hater who sits on the city council for the city of Portland. So I wanted to talk to Daryl Turner, who's the executive director of the union that represents cops, the Portland Police Association. Daryl, I've got my own attitudes about Joanne Hardesty. I think she hates the cops. I document that. She's called the cops liars. She's accused you of committing arson. She gets special protection for herself by having a 900 box in her home where she can just push a button and get a two-car lights and siren, full-tilt emergency response anytime she wants it. But she seems to have very low regard for police officers. And now on the subject of the rise in violent crime, which the FBI says is mostly gang activity, she simply denies that it's the problem at all. So can you tackle all of that, Daryl? And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lars. And I think I can try to. Number one, she was the main proponent for disbanding the gun violence reduction team in 2020. She was one of the main proponents for defunding the Portland Police Bureau in 2020. Every month since that time, the rise in shootings, the rise in homicides have gone up. More than 65% of the people who are being shot in the city of Portland are African-American. Plain fact. You're talking about a city council that's data-driven. That's the facts. Those are the facts, and that's the data. Since that time, every month, shootings and homicides have gone up, and now we're at record proportions for both. We have a gang violence problem in this city. That doesn't mean all the shootings are gang-related, but a large percentage are gang-related, and gang violence is at its peak since the 1990s. And it's all because city council defunded us in 2020, disbanded the gang violence reduction team, and again, defunded the police in 2021 also. Now we're looking at a fall budget bump in October, and the police are asking for money so we can help to stop curbing some of this violence. So we'll see which way all the commissioners vote after all that we have seen and all that we have said over this last year. I will tell you this. There are bodies in the street, and those bodies are on people in city council who decided to defund the police, who decided to disband the gang violence reduction team that took hundreds of guns off the street, arrested suspects who were involved in multiple shootings, and also were proactive on the streets of stopping shootings. And now we see this rise, and you can't tell me that's not consistent with the defunding and the disbanding of the police.
Daryl, understand this, that I want to point out to my audience, they may not know, you're an African-American, so is Joanne Hardesty, but you don't wear it like a chip on your shoulder. I think Joanne Hardesty wears race as a chip on both shoulders, and I think the reason she's saying this is not gangs is that whether you like it or not, gangs in America, gangs here in the Northwest, are predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly made up of persons of color. Which means that she is saying this isn't the gangs because she doesn't like the conclusion that two-thirds of the victims are people of color and that most of the shooters are people of color. And if she admits it's gangs, she's got to go down that path. Is that why she's refusing to admit that the gangs predominantly are the cause of this dramatic rise in violent crime?
I personally believe the reason why she's not going to admit, or anybody who doesn't admit, that the gang violence is at its peak in the city right now is because of the defunding and the disbanding of the gun violence reduction team. She was a main proponent. There were other, every commissioner that was in office at that time were main proponents of that. That mistake has left bodies on the street, has left people without family members that are no longer with them anymore. They're not speaking for the victims at all, because if they were speaking for the victims, they would have funded the police. They would have brought back a unit that did the job that the gun violence reduction team has done over the past years, and that they did not do that. And still today, they're in denial. Some of the commissioners are in denial, but those are on their feet. Those bodies are on their feet.
Well, Daryl, look, I there are a lot of subjects in the world today that we end up talking about on this show that I don't think are related to race at all. This one is one where I think race is right at the core of it. And let me tell you why, and I'm telling my audience at the same time, because if you say, well, race has nothing to do with this, well, if most of the gangs in America, the Mexican-American gangs, Latino gangs, black gangs, et cetera, make up the majority of the gangs that are doing violence in America, and you say, but I don't want that to be the cause, tell me if I'm not accurate. Doing away with the gun violence reduction team was because the GVRT had to go out and arrest and stop and hopefully charge and cause to be prosecuted gang members who were predominantly people of color. And that was Joanne Hardesty's biggest objection to the gang violence reduction team, was that it caused people of color to get arrested, charged, in some cases, prosecuted, convicted, and thrown in prison. That was her big beef, wasn't it?
But on the other hand, the gang violence reduction team, what they did was gave closure to many families, people of color, who were victims of that gang violence. And so they need to look at the victims as well as look at the suspects, because it doesn't matter who the suspects are and who the victims are. What matters is if Joanne Hardesty is going to say that she is a candidate who is a proponent for people of color, then she needs to stand up and be that, because those victims are people of color also. And she's not doing that. She's not standing with those victims who are people of color. She's standing on her own agenda, because it's a self-serving agenda.
And I agree with you. And Daryl, what I'm wondering is when the leaders within the black community, not just black elected leaders like Lou Fredericks, but also people on school boards, people in churches, people in other positions, when are they going to stand up and say, look, you can't object to arresting people because some people get arrested who happen to be people of color, when we have two-thirds of the murders, as you just said, are being committed, the victims are people of color. And we're going to stand up for the innocent people, not for the guilty people who end up getting charged. When is the community going to do that?
And we hear people in the community doing that. People like Antoinette Edwards, who was worked for the city for over a decade and was a proponent for the gun violence reduction team, but also was a proponent for reform, but also was an expert in gang, expert about gang violence. We also heard from people like Nike Green. We also hear from people like Pastor Hennessy. So there are people in the black community that are rising up. Their voices are being drowned out by the people who are not subject matter experts, who are not affected by the gang violence, and who are not proponents of the victims.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And by the way, Daryl, I think it's the height of hypocrisy that somebody who sits on a city council draws a public paycheck and enjoys a special level of police protection would try to take it away from other people based on her racial issues and her racial problems. That's Daryl Turner, the director, the executive director of the PPA. We'll be back with your phone calls and emails on a First Amendment Friday. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Our Twitter poll today, and you can find it a couple of places, both on Twitter, at Lars Larson Show, and at LarsLarson.com, if you're not a fan of Jack Dorsey's little censored website or censored internet operation. Once approved, should Northwest schools require vaccination, COVID vaccination, of your kids for school attendance? I'd say no to that. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let me go first to Stephen. Hey, Stephen, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. Real quickly, I'm one of these truck drivers that you've been talking about. I work for a large motor carrier, 4,000 drivers out on the road.
Wow.
And as of today, and you know we're heavily regulated by the feds, but as of today, there's absolutely zero pressure on me to get the vaccine.
Good.
No threats of, my employer isn't even talking about it. And my employer is the kind of employer that if there was pressure from the feds, we would be getting told, get the vaccine or you're fired. Nothing. Thought I'd ask you if you knew why.
I'm going to guess that some of the employers feel more pressure based on where they're located, what state they're in, what's been ordered of them by the state governor, and whether or not they do any federal business. So, for instance, if your company, say, hauled a lot of mail for the post office and they had federal contracts to do that, that would probably change their point of view. Because I've been hearing from a lot of workers who say, look, I don't work for the government, but our company does some work for the government. So now because of that, they're extending the mandate. And frankly, Stephen, I go right back to the point that your status, your health care and your health status and your vaccination status is your private business. I mean, a lot of people have raised the question. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't really answer it directly. But do you think any employer has a right to say to you, Stephen, have you been vaccinated? And I would say he doesn't have the right to ask that. Now, remember, I'm not a lawyer any more than Stephen, do you have an STD? Or Stephen, do you have hepatitis? Or Stephen, do you have AIDS? Now, there are certain things that you know come up in that medical exam that as a driver you've got to take periodically. I think unless you're on sort of probation, you have to get it every couple of years, don't you?
That's correct. And that would be a great way for the feds to enforce a vaccine mandate. Say, hey, show you got the vaccine or we're not qualifying you medically.
Except, Stephen, as I understand, and you correct me if I'm wrong, when you go in for a medical, they focus on things that directly affect you as a driver. So if your eyesight is screwed up, that affects you as a driver. If you've got sleep apnea, I understand that's an issue for drivers. If you've got diabetes, especially type 1, I don't know whether that actually disqualifies you as a driver, but I think it has a serious effect. If you've had a heart attack, it has an effect. Now, could they ask you, do you have think of something that's outside of all these things we've already talked about. Do you have an artificial hip? They might say, well, what does that have to do with whether he can drive or not? He can either drive or he can't drive. So I think the feds might have a tough time saying, we're going to ask you about this, even though it may or may not have anything to do with what you do as a driver, a medical condition that does not affect your ability to drive the truck. I mean, if you get the flu tomorrow and you're puking your guts out, I assume they don't say, well, no, anybody who can get the flu can't be a truck driver, because probably long before you start, you know, running a fever and throwing up and all that, you're going to say, I'm pulling this truck over because I can't drive when I'm this sick. So that would have an effect, but they don't ask you about that because they know the day you get really sick and you can't do the job, you're going to pull yourself off the road, right?
Correct.
Okay.
But then I would have to wonder about these airline pilots.
Well, as I understand, the tie-through for a lot of the airline pilots is because most of the airlines do some business with the federal government. They haul mail. They haul other things. They have contracts to haul passengers who are federal employees being moved from A to B, you know, things like that. And they fly in and out of federally regulated facilities. You don't necessarily do that. I don't know what you drive or what you carry, but it may be the fact that your company doesn't have any direct ties to the federal government. But the real essential question, I think, Stephen, and thanks for the call, is should we be telling people you must do this or you can't have your ticket to work? Let's go to Sam. Hey, Sam, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Love your show, man.
Thank you, sir.
I work for Boeing, and they put a mandate out on us to get vaccinated.
And they do lots of federal business, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, so that's where we're held tight. So today we staged a little bit of a walkout, I would say. We used our sick benefits to leave 2 hours early, and there's about 100 of us out of just one building that left.
What I'm curious what the attitude of your coworkers is about that. Do they say, hey, just go out and get the jab, or do they support the idea that you should be able to make a decision on your own health care?
I want to say it's about 60-40 in support of make your own decision.
That's good.
Yeah, it is good. We had a lot of people leave today, even people that were vaccinated. They don't want to be told what to do, you know. So.
Yeah, and I hope they realize, Sam, because I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that if this government says, any government, either state or federal, says, we've now got citizens who we call ourselves public servants because we serve them, but we're now calling the shots. If we tell them to do something and say, and if you don't do it, we're going to make your life miserable. We may take away your paycheck, your career. We may make it impossible for your business to operate. Do we want the kind of relationship with our government where the government says, we're going to tell you people what to do, and you're going to do it. And if you don't do it, you're going to wish you were dead.
I think definitely not. So basically what we've been told is if we're not fully vaccinated by December 8th, we don't have a job anymore.
Well, I'm curious what's going to happen in federal court, Sam, because I think some of this is going to, we've already had a bunch of federal judges, one in Texas, one in New York State, that have already slapped down vaccine mandates, said, nope, you can't do that. We've had some other judges who've gone the other direction. So in some ways, we have to wait and see what's going to happen to that when it gets to the appeals courts and then when it finally goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. But that may take some time. In the meantime, if the judges are splitting one direction or the other, we really don't have any idea as a country where things are going. And of course, the transportation secretary, Pete Buttigieg, has decided to take 2 months off for paternity leave right in the middle of a transportation crisis. Sam, thanks for the call. Let's go to Barbara. Hey, Barbara, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I'm a longtime listener and a longtime naysayer. So
thank you.
Good to talk to you.
Are we agreeing today or disagreeing?
Well, I want your take because I'm a retired teacher, but I'm still an active substitute. And there's always been vaccinations for kids, and there's always been exclusion dates for kids that, you know, and of course you can always have a medical or a religious exemption. I mean, that's always been. So why is it any different now?
It's different now for a bunch of reasons. Let's start with an experimental vaccine, emergency use authorization, quickly approved for kids. And then you say, what are you being protected against? Well, COVID. What's the chance that kids are going to get it? Fairly low. What's the chance they're going to be hugely affected by it, either very, very sick or perhaps even dying? Very, very low. What's the chance that the vaccine will cause known side effects for children as well as adults? Well, that's also low, but it's also there. So for me, Barbara, it comes down to weighing the risks, the known risks of COVID and the known risks of the vaccination, and then say, which one should we do? Back in a moment.
Both of these bills spend out over 10 years. Take the infrastructure bill. All those investments in roads, bridges, highways, high-speed internet, water, clean water, everything that represent less than one half of 1% of our economy each year, if you add it all up over the years. And the cost of the Build Back Better bill in terms of adding to the deficit is zero. So when I hear people say it costs $3.5 trillion, and be honest with you, we're probably not going to get $3.5 trillion this year. We're going to get something less than that.
That is Joe Biden just a few hours ago explaining, well, I guess you can call an explanation. When the president of the United States says we're going to spend $3.5 trillion, but it's not going to cost you anything. I mean, you know better than to think that. I'm sure your mom and dad told you if it sounds too good to be true, like spending $3.5 trillion, but with no actual cost to it whatsoever, you want to ask, what's the catch? Well, the guy I've got with me to explain that catch is Ray Keating, who serves as chief economist for the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council. Ray, welcome back to the show. Can you help my audience and me make sense of the president explaining that $3.5 trillion might be spent with zero actual cost? Oh, and by the way, nobody but the hyper, hyper rich are going to see their taxes go up. And welcome.
Yeah, well, good to be with you, Lars. Yeah, I have this urge as an economist to reach out to the president and, you know, just try to walk
him
through
by the lapels.
101. Yeah, right, exactly. But, yeah, I mean, listen, anytime there's some fundamentals here that the president either is ignorant of or has chosen to ignore. But if government spends $3.5 trillion, they have to get those resources from somewhere. And whether they get it through borrowing or through taxes, that means they're going to be drained from the private sector, where they will be used far more productively by businesses and consumers and so on, and then handed over to the president and members of Congress to be spent according to their political preferences. So that's the bottom line here. You can't just, you know, pretend that it's manna from heaven. These are very real costs we're talking about.
Well, and let me ask you about his claim. He said, well, the infrastructure bill, that's another $1.2 trillion. I think when you total all the things up, the federal government budget plus the $3.5 trillion in social welfare plus $1.2 trillion in so-called infrastructure, you're looking at somewhere around $9 trillion in spending. And then there are the programs in there that are only paid for a couple of years in the program, which we all know once they're established, they're not going to go away, but the cost will still be there. I've compared it, Ray, to telling your friends, I bought a $60,000 pickup truck. And you go, whoa, what's that going to cost you? 12 grand. You say, well, 12 yeah. grand for, and you say, yeah, this year. And they say, well, aren't you paying for it for more than 1 year? Oh yeah, it's 12 grand a year for the next 6 years, but it's only 12 grand this year. You know, nobody in the real world behaves that way, do they?
No, they don't. They can't. They're not allowed to. But this is politics, and politicians say whatever they want. But, you know, again, you can't change the economics. And when you start tallying these things up, and then you look at, you know, the tax increases that he's proposing, and you look at the increases in debt. I mean, these are all things that are going to hurt our economy. Let's you know, do a little reminder here that we're coming out of a pandemic economy. We're trying to get back on track. We've lost, you know, hundreds of thousands of small businesses across this country, millions of jobs. We have a long way to go here. The last thing that government should be doing, I mean, in good times or bad, but particularly bad times, should be talking about trillions of dollars more in government spending, and then obviously massive tax increases that are going to discourage entrepreneurship and investment. You know, racking up debt, which means that they're going to be cost today and tomorrow. So it's mind blowing on a certain level, but the president's playing a very dangerous game here. And all the, if, you know, even a fraction of this stuff gets pushed through, there are going to be very real costs in terms of lost economic growth, lost jobs, lost income, you know, keep going down the list.
Well, let me ask you about this. He's also pushed this point of view. Oh, this is all about roads and bridges and highways and, you know, water systems and stuff. Out of the infrastructure bill, isn't that about 9% of the bill? And the other 91% is electric car chargers and subsidies for rich people to buy electric cars and other stuff that is not about roads, bridges, highways, and water systems. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And again, what you can do in politics is just, you know, change the meaning of words. And that's what we're doing here. So we used to understand infrastructure to be roads and bridges and so on. But now it's just kind of everything under the sun. And we call it all investment now. It's not government spending. And people just need to be paying attention here to what's actually going on and getting past the political rhetoric to the realities. And again, the realities are not pretty at all.
Ray Keating is the chief economist of the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council. Let's get to the tax side of this, because, again, a few hours ago, Joe Biden said Nobody's going to pay if you make less than $400,000 a year. And I think he threw up a teacher and a construction worker, a teacher and a cop. Well, hold on. Teacher and cop in many cities or many places in America are making north of $100,000. So they're going to pay because he says this is all the $400,000 crowd and above. You know, so it's Bill Gates, it's Warren Buffett, it's Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. They're going to be paying the bill. You're off the hook. Would you please tell my audience, are they off the hook? Because I don't think they are.
No, if you think that, you know, everybody's an, you know, every man is an economic island, you know, maybe you could get away with it, maybe, but you can't because we're all interrelated. So if you are, look, you know, when you look at the list of tax increases, higher corporate income tax, well, guess what? Most corporations happen to be small businesses. The president and his administration have gone out of their way to assure people that's not the case. You look at the actual numbers, it is the case. When you're talking about a higher top individual tax rate, well, guess what? A huge portion of those people, again, are small business owners and entrepreneurs. When you're talking about a higher capital gains tax, well, what is a capital gains tax? It's a tax on the returns on investment. What does investment do? Well, my goodness, we start up businesses with investment. We grow businesses. We create jobs. We grow the economy. It's all interrelated here. And the notion that you can get away with taxing somebody over there because they at a certain income level and it's not going to affect anybody else is just ridiculous. It's not real economics. It's politics. Unfortunately, we've heard it time and time again, but this president does seem to be taking it to a level that I think might even embarrass some of his colleagues on that side of the aisle in the past.
Well, Ray, I'm wondering what you think when you see Jen Psaki saying, oh, pshaw, the idea that corporations would see their costs go up either from energy or from taxes and pass that along to, oh, that's hogwash. That doesn't happen. So all these small business, even the person out there making less than $400,000, he and his wife own a small convenience store or a small manufacturing plant, and they don't make more than a couple of $100,000 a year. But everything they buy, they rent their space, their building from a corporation, they buy their materials from a corporation, all those costs are going to go up because the corporations are going to pass these costs along, aren't they?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They're going to pass these costs along. They're not going to make investments that they normally would, again, in a vital time where we need those investments. You know what? I know that many people on the left try to tell us that taxes don't matter, regulations don't matter, businesses and entrepreneurs will just do what they're going to do anyway. Well, that's patently false. I mean, this is the decisions of businesses and entrepreneurs. If you want to get them to stop risk-taking, to stop investing, the surest path is to raise their taxes and, by the way, also increase regulatory costs. And that's exactly what's going on right now.
Now, he's still trying to sell it, although he did make an interesting admission today, Ray, and I took note of it. I don't know if you heard it in that soundbite, but he said, yeah, we're probably not going to get the $3.5 trillion. I mean, this whole thing has been languishing for a while because you got, you know, the most radical side, the AOC, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib bunch, that say $3.5 trillion is far too small, even if it's understated and should be $5.5 trillion. And then the other, say, more moderate end of the Democrat wing that says, no, it can't be that big, you know, the Joe Manchin types. And Joe even admitted today, hours ago, it ain't going to pass at $3.5 trillion. That's Ray Keating from the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council. Ray, thanks very much. We'll be back. It's First Amendment Friday. Your phone calls and emails coming up next. Welcome back on First Amendment Friday and the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to be with you on this segment of the show brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs. They'll give you the ultimate hot tub and swim spa experience. Visit them online or visit one of their three bricks and mortar locations, MarqueeHotTubs.com. To your calls now. Let me go first to Steve. I'm kind of curious. Steve's in Tacoma listening on KVI and the Radio Northwest Network. Steve, what's on your mind today?
Well, hello, Lars.
Hi, what's up?
Nobody talks about the consulate they want to put in Israel for Palestine.
I did this week. When you say nobody, are you including
you
me? Yeah. And I know Ari Hoffman, my buddy at KVI, he's talked about it. I can't remember if John Carlson has or not, but you want to let the audience know what this is about?
Yeah, it's to basically undermine Israel.
Yep. Well, but we have to tell people what it is, Steve, because you're joining a conversation that includes a lot of people in the three-state region. What Steve's referring to is Donald Trump was the first president to follow a law that was co-introduced by Joe Biden about 25 years ago. And it said something very simple. It said the U.S. will put its embassy in the capital of Israel called Jerusalem. And then every single president since then, Joe introduced it when he was co-sponsored it when he was in the Senate. Every single president, Clinton, George W., Obama, they all just ignored the law and said, it's in the law, but we're not going to do it. So finally, Donald Trump said, I'm going to follow through. First American president to do so. And he put the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, which is the right place for it to be, just like our embassy in France. The main embassy is in Paris, and the embassy in Germany would be in Berlin. You'd put it in the capital city. But there was a message to that, to the Palestinians, saying, yes, Jerusalem is in fact the capital of the state of Israel. And that, of course, made all the Palestinians and Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib go crazy. So now Biden is proposing to put a consulate in Jerusalem. And you might say, well, if you already have an embassy in the city, why do you need a consulate, right? Like we have consulates in places like San Francisco because you say you need something that represents that country. You know, so if France wants to have a San Francisco consulate, their embassy is in Washington, D.C. Their consulate is in, say, San Francisco. There might even be one in, Miami or some other places. So why are they doing this? Biden proposes to put a consulate in Jerusalem that is only going to deal with so-called Palestinian affairs. And you say, well, doesn't the country of Palestine have a right to a consulate? And you say, there is no such thing as a country of Palestine. It does not. There is no Palestinian country. There might be someday. There is not today. So why is Joe doing it? He's doing it because the Palestinians say Jerusalem is our capital city. And when we've killed all the Jews or pushed them into the sea, then we will take back Jerusalem and it will belong to us and the Jews will all be dead. You think I got all that about right?
Yes, absolutely.
I want to ask you a question. What do you think about an American president named Biden suggesting by wanting to put a consulate there that basically someday the Jews are going to be dead, Israel won't exist, and the Arab Muslims will control that city and that country?
That's what I tried to get on Ari's show to yesterday and ask him about it.
But I'm asking you, should an American president be endorsing the idea that our ally Israel should cease to exist and that its Jewish people should be dead or gone?
Absolutely not.
That's where I thought you were going with it. So, Steve, people aren't talking about it. Let's go to Lee. Hey, Lee, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
You mentioned earlier the state of Washington was giving a tax or something for health care.
Long-term care, not health care. What Jay Inslee and the legislature have done, and it's a fraud. What they've said is we want a tax on all working people from their income. Now, Washington State does not allow income taxes, but they're going to try to do it anyway. The tax comes out to 58 cents for every $100 you make. So to make the math easy for an idiot like me, Lee, if you made $100,000, you'd pay $580 a year in taxes. And if you say, well, what am I buying for that? You're buying long-term care. So either you get old and you need long-term care, or you get in a car wreck or some other kind of medical malady and you need long-term care, either for a short time or till you're dead. And Jay Inslee says this will do it. The only problem is that they're going to collect from a lot of people who are automatically going to be disqualified. Meaning, if you pay the tax for 9.5 years, but don't pay for 10 years, you don't get anything. If you pay the tax for 12 years, more than the 10-year minimum, and then you move out of the state of Washington into Oregon, California, Idaho, anywhere else, you don't get anything. Oh, and by the way, if you do happen to pay the tax for more than 10 years, stay in the state of Washington, and you collect, do you know how much you collect, Lee? $36,500 is the maximum lifetime benefit. Do you know what that buys you in terms of nursing home?
Not a year.
Three and a half months. The average cost of nursing care, long-term care in Washington State is $11,000 and change a month. So you're going to charge a whole bunch of people a tax that the vast majority of them have not a snowball's chance of collecting on. And even if they do collect, the benefit they collect will be so tiny, it'll be a blip. So you get to 65 or 70, you say, I need to go into long-term care. I'm not doing that well. I need some help in my daily activities. You say, good, you got 3.5 months, and if you're not dead then, you're paying the bill. That's Jay Inslee's gift to Washington State, and this is the Lars Larson Show.